From the archives of the Key West Literary Seminar, 2003, a reading by Billy Collins.
It's a pleasure to be in your company and to be in all the sunshine. Like Charles Simic, about 40 hours ago, I was shoveling snow also, and I thought I would start by reading a poem called Shoveling Snow with Buddha. Shoveling Snow with Buddha. In the usual iconography of the temple, or the local walk, you would never see him doing such a thing, tossing the dry snow over the mountain of his bare round shoulder, his hair tied in a knot, a model of concentration. Sitting is more his speed, if that is the word for what he does or does not do. Even the season is wrong for him. In all his manifestations, is it not warm and slightly humid? Is this not implied by his serene expression, that smile so wide it wraps itself around the waist of the universe? But here we are, working our way down the driveway, one shovelful at a time. We toss the light powder into the clear air. We feel the cold mist on our faces. And with every heave, we disappear and become lost to each other in these sudden clouds of our own making, these fountain bursts of snow. This is so much better than a sermon in church, I say out loud, but Buddha keeps on shoveling. This is the true religion, the religion of snow and sunlight and winter geese barking in the sky, I say, but he is too busy to hear me. He has thrown himself into shoveling snow as if it were the purpose of existence, as if the sign of a perfect life were a clear driveway. You could back the car down easily and drive off into the vanities of the world with a broken heater fan and a song on the radio. All morning long, we work side by side, me with my commentary and he inside the generous pocket of his silence, until the hour is nearly noon and the snow is piled high all around us. Then I hear him speak. After this, he asks, can we go inside and play cards? Certainly, I reply, and I will heat some milk and bring cups of hot chocolate to the table while you shuffle the deck and our boots stand dripping by the door. Ah, says the Buddha, lifting his eyes and leaning for a moment on his shovel before he drives the thin blade again deep into the glittering white snow. Thank you. This poem is called Monday. It's a pretty dull title, but that's what stuck with. Monday. The birds are in their trees, the toaster is in the toast, the toast is in the toaster, and the poets are at their windows. They are at their windows in every section of the tangerine of earth. The Chinese poets looking up at the moon, the American poets gazing out at the pink and blue ribbons of sunrise. The clerks are at their desks, the miners are down in their mines, and the poets are looking out their windows, maybe with a cigarette, a cup of tea, and maybe a flannel shirt or a bathrobe is involved. The proofreaders are playing the ping-pong game of proofreading, glancing back and forth from page to page. The chefs are dicing celery and potatoes, and the poets are at their windows because it is their job, for which they are paid nothing every Friday afternoon. What window, it hardly seems to matter, though many have a favorite, for there is always something to see, a bird grasping a thin branch, the headlights of a taxi rounding a corner, those two boys in wool caps angling across the street. The fishermen bob in their boats, the linemen climb their round poles, the barbers wait by their mirrors and chairs, and the poets continue to stare at the cracked birdbath or a limb knocked down by the wind. By now, it should go without saying that what the oven is to the baker and the berry-stained blouse to the dry cleaner, so the window is to the poet. Just think, before the invention of the window, the poets would have to put on a jacket and a winter hat to go outside or remain indoors with only a wall to stare at. And when I say a wall, I do not mean a wall with striped wallpaper and a sketch of a cow in a frame. I mean a cold wall of field stones, the wall of the medieval sonnet, the original woman's heart of stone, the stone caught in the throat of her poet lover. Here's a very small poem that had a rather ordinary origin. I read in an article on printing this sentence, and the sentence is, "It has been calculated that each copy of the Gutenberg Bible required the skins of 300 sheep." And the poem is called Flock. I can see them squeezed into a holding pen behind the stone building where the printing press is housed, all of them squirming around and in search of a little room, and all looking so much alike, it would be extremely difficult to count them. And there is no telling which one will carry the news that the Lord is a shepherd, one of the few things they already know. And here's a poem about a childhood fear. I was looking at this podium before, which I was thinking of not reading behind because I think it's my peasant Irish background that makes me suspicious about anything with a crest on it. And I'm not sure what family that represents, but they probably weren't very nice to my ancestors. But it's a kind of about the grain that you see in wood such as that. And it's called Creatures. Hamlet noticed them in the shapes of clouds, but I saw them in the furniture of childhood. Creatures trapped under surfaces of wood, one submerged in a polished sideboard, one frowning from a chair back, another howling from my mother's silent bureau, locked in the grain of maple frozen in oak. I would see these presences, too, in a swirling pattern of wallpaper or in the various greens of a porcelain lamp, each looking so melancholy, so damned, some peering out at me as if they knew all the secrets of a secretive boy. Many times I would be daydreaming on the carpet and one would appear next to me, the oversized nose, the hollow look. So you will understand my reaction this morning at the beach when you opened your hand to show me a stone you had picked up from the shoreline. "Do you see the face?" you asked as the cold surf circled our bare ankles. "There's the eye and the line of the mouth, like it's grimacing, like it's in pain." Well, maybe that's because it has a fissure running down the length of its forehead, not to mention a kind of twisted beak, I said, taking the thing from you and flinging it out over the sparkle of blue waves so it could live out its freakish existence on the dark bottom of the sea and stop bothering innocent beachgoers like us, stop ruining everyone's summer. Thank you. And this is a poem that just began, as a lot of poems do, with a word, and the word had a kind of an echo for me, and I listened to the echo, and it's called The Lanyard. The other day, as I was ricocheting slowly off the blue walls of this room, bouncing from typewriter to piano, from bookshelf to an envelope lying on the floor, I found myself in the L section of the dictionary, where my eyes fell upon the word lanyard. No cookie nibbled by a French novelist could send one more suddenly into the past, a past where I sat at a workbench at a camp by a deep Adirondack lake, learning how to braid thin plastic strips into a lanyard, a gift for my mother. I had never seen anyone use a lanyard, or wear one, if that's what you did with them, but that did not keep me from crossing strand over strand again and again until I had made a boxy red and white lanyard for my mother. She gave me life and milk from her breasts, and I gave her a lanyard. She nursed me in many a sick room, lifted teaspoons of medicine to my lips, set cold face cloths on my forehead, and then led me out into the airy light and taught me to walk and swim, and I in turn presented her with a lanyard. "Here are thousands of meals," she said, "and here is clothing and a good education. And here is your lanyard," I replied, which I made with a little help from a counselor. Here is a breathing body and a beating heart, strong legs, bones, and teeth, and two clear eyes to read the world, she whispered. And here, I said, is the lanyard I made at camp. And here, I wish to say to her now, is a smaller gift, not the archaic truth that you can never repay your mother, but the rueful admission that when she took the two-tone lanyard from my hands, I was as sure as a boy could be that this useless, worthless thing I wove out of boredom would be enough to make us even. I read most of these poems, I think, are pretty self-explanatory. I hope so. I just read a piece of advice from Julian Barnes, who said to some other writer, he said, a younger person, he said, never read at a reading, you know. They would rather hear what you had for breakfast. I had a muffin for breakfast, so and I don't really believe that. But this poem is called The Country. It's about a friend of mine who lives in the country in Vermont and tried to teach me a little lesson about a fine point of safety, I suppose, that country people seem to know about, that I didn't know about, the country. I wondered about you when you told me never to leave a box of wooden strike anywhere matches lying around the house because the mice might get into them and start a fire. But your face was absolutely straight when you twisted the lid down on the round tin where the matches, you said, are always stowed. Who could sleep that night? Who could whisk away the thought of the one unlikely mouse padding along a cold water pipe behind the floral wallpaper, gripping a single wooden match between the needles of his teeth? Who could not see him rounding a corner, the blue tip scratching against a rough-hewn beam, the sudden flare, and the creature for one bright, shining moment suddenly thrust ahead of his time, now a fire starter, now a torchbearer in a forgotten ritual, little brown druid illuminating some ancient night. And who could fail to notice, lit up in the blazing insulation, the tiny looks of wonderment on the faces of his fellow mice, one-time inhabitants of what once was your house in the country. Thanks. Here are, I read two fairly short poems, one based on a kind of something you hear regularly, kind of a stock thing that comes up on radio broadcasts. And it's called Surprise. This, according to the voice on the radio, the host of a classical music program, no less, this is the birthday of Vivaldi. He would be 325 years old today, quite bent over, I would imagine, and not able to see much through his watery eyes. Surely he would be deaf by now, the clothes flaking off him, hair pitiably sparse. But we would throw a party for him anyway, a surprise party where everyone would hide behind the furniture to listen for the tap of his cane on the pavement and the sound of his dry, persistent cough. And this is even shorter. I always think about Philip Larkin's comment that he got no one of the anxieties he experienced in attending poetry readings, which he tried to avoid if he could, was that he said he could never tell when the poem was going to end. And whereas if you have the poem in front of you and you have it printed, you can see the ending coming up and you can begin to make emotional preparations. So this poem is 8 lines long, so you can start to get ready probably right about now. And it's called No Time, No Time. In a rush this weekday morning, I tap the horn as I speed past the cemetery where my parents are buried side by side under a smooth slab of granite. Then all day long I think of him rising up to give me that look of knowing disapproval, while my mother calmly tells him to lie back down. I'd put out to you as a challenge to write a poem about your dead parents that makes people laugh. Sometimes I think the poet's relationship to experience is very as simple as that of someone who is. Whoops, I'm okay. Just get electrocuted there. Be careful if you come up here. I'm standing in a puddle. So sometimes I think you just want to get down what's sort of in front of you, and this poem is really very descriptive, written very quickly on a train, and it's called Love. The boy at the far end of the train car kept looking behind him as if he were afraid or expecting someone, and then she appeared in the glass door of the forward car, and he rose and opened the door and let her in, and she entered the car carrying a large black case in the unmistakable shape of a cello. She looked like an angel with a high forehead and somber eyes, and her hair was tied up behind her neck with a black bow. And because of all that, he seemed a little awkward in his happiness to see her, whereas she was simply there, perfectly existing as a creature with a soft face who played the cello. And the reason I am writing this on the back of a manila envelope, now that they have left the train together, is to tell you that when she turned to lift the large, delicate cello onto the overhead rack, I saw him looking up at her and what she was doing, the way the eyes of saints are painted when they are looking up at God, when he is doing something remarkable, something that identifies him as God. I read a slightly, I'm okay, slightly formal, am I smoke coming out of my ears or anything? I read a slightly more formal poem called Sonnet. In the sonnet I mention sort of the father of the sonnet, Petrarch, and the woman to whom he addressed his sonnets, Laura. Sonnet. All we need is 14 lines. Well, 13 now. And after this one, just a dozen to launch a little ship on love's storm-tossed seas. Then only 10 more left, like rows of beans. How easily it goes, unless you get Elizabethan and insist the iambic bongos must be played, and rhymes positioned at the ends of lines, one for every station of the cross. But hang on here while we make the turn into the final six, where all will be resolved, where longing and heartache will find an end, where Laura will tell Petrarch to put down his pen, take off those crazy medieval tights, blow out the lights, and come at last to bed. Thank you very much. Here's a poem called Japan. It's a little meditation on a haiku. Japan. Today I pass the time reading a favorite haiku, saying the few words over and over. It feels like eating the same small perfect grape again and again. I walk through the house reciting it and leave its letters falling through the air of every room. I stand by the big silence of the piano and say it. I say it in front of a painting of the sea. I tap out its rhythm on an empty shelf. I listen to myself saying it, then I say it without listening, then I hear it without saying it. And when the dog looks up at me, I kneel down on the floor and whisper it into each of his long white ears. It's the one about the one-ton temple bell with the moth sleeping on its surface. And every time I say it, I feel the excruciating pressure of the moth on the surface of the iron bell. When I say it at the window, The bell is the world, and I am the moth resting there. When I say it into the mirror, I am the heavy bell, and the moth is life with its papery wings. And later, when I say it to you in the dark, you are the bell, and I am the tongue of the bell ringing you. And the moth has flown from its line and moves like a hinge in the air above our bed. I think judging by the average to rough view of the average age of the audience that you can probably get with this poem called Forgetfulness. I wrote it after I read a piece by Patrick. I wasn't actually planning that, but Patrick Susskind, who wrote an article called Literary Amnesia about just forgetting everything you've read, pretty much. So that's where the poem begins, Forgetfulness. The name of the author is the first to go, followed obediently by the title, the plot, the heartbreaking conclusion, the entire novel, which suddenly becomes one you have never read, never even heard of. It is as if, one by one, the memories you used to harbor decided to retire to the southern hemisphere of the brain, to a little fishing village where there are no phones. Long ago, you kissed the names of the nine muses goodbye, and you watched the quadratic equation pack its bag. And even now, as you memorize the order of the planet, something else is slipping away, a state flower, perhaps, the address of an uncle, the capital of Paraguay. Whatever it is you are struggling to remember, it is not poised on the tip of your tongue, not even lurking in some obscure corner of your spleen. It has floated away down a dark, mythological river whose name begins with an L, as far as you can recall. Well, on your own way to oblivion, where you will join those who have forgotten even how to swim and how to ride a bicycle. No wonder you rise in the middle of the night to look up the date of a famous battle in a book on war. No wonder the moon in the window seems to have drifted out of a love poem that you used to know by heart. Thank you. This is a poem about having to stay home one summer instead of taking a little European trip. It's called Consolation. I kind of wrote it to console myself about that lack of travel. Consolation. How agreeable it is not to be touring Italy this summer, wandering her cities and ascending her torrid hill towns. How much better to cruise these local familiar streets, fully grasping the meaning of every road sign and billboard, and all the sudden hand gestures of my compatriots. There are no abbeys here, no crumbling frescoes or famous domes, and there is no need to memorize a succession of kings or tour the dripping corners of a dungeon. No need to stand around a sarcophagus, see Napoleon's little bed on Elba, or view the bones of a saint under glass. How much better to command the simple precinct of home than be dwarfed by pillar, arch, and basilica? Why hide my head in phrasebooks and wrinkled maps? Why feed scenery into a hungry, one-eyed camera, eager to eat the world one monument at a time? Instead of slouching in a cafe, ignorant of the word for ice, I will head down to the coffee shop and to the waitress known as Dot. I will slide into the flow of the morning paper, all language barriers down, rivers of idiom running freely, eggs over easy on the way. And after breakfast, I will not have to find someone willing to photograph me with my arm around the owner. I will not puzzle over the bill or record in a journal what I had to eat and how the sun came in the window. It is enough to climb back into the car as if it were the great car of English itself, and sounding my loud vernacular horn, speed off down a road that will never lead to Rome, not even Bologna. Thanks very much. I'll read two more poems if that's all right. Birthdays are a great occasion for writing poems, especially if it's your birthday. I don't know if Dorianne Locks has written a poem today about her birthday, but it's a kind of a sub genre of poetry, writing poems about your own birthday, particularly when the number ends with a zero. Then you're almost obliged to commemorate it with a poem. And generally, these poems share the same atmosphere. You know, the barometric pressure is pretty moist, and they're quite gloomy. And in an attempt to get to the source of all this despondency, I wrote this poem called On Turning 10. On Turning 10. The whole idea of it makes me feel like I'm coming down with something. Something worse than any stomach ache or the headaches I get from reading in bad light. A kind of measles of the spirit, a mumps of the psyche. You tell me it is too early to be looking back, but that is because you have forgotten the perfect simplicity of being one and the beautiful complexity introduced by two. But I can lie on my bed and remember every digit. At four, I was an Arabian wizard. I could make myself invisible by drinking a glass of milk a certain way. At seven, I was a soldier. At nine, a prince. But now I am mostly at the window, watching the late afternoon light. Back then, it never fell so solemnly against the side of my treehouse, and my bicycle never leaned against the garage as it does today, all the dark blue speed drained out of it. This is the beginning of sadness, I say to myself as I walk through the universe in my sneakers. It is time to say goodbye to my imaginary friends, time to turn the first big number. It seems only yesterday I used to believe there was nothing under my skin but light. If you cut me, I would shine. But now, when I fall upon the sidewalks of life, I skin my knees, I bleed. Thank you for being such an attentive audience. And I'll close with a poem that I like to end with. It's a poem called Nightclub, and I mention in it a singer named Johnny Hartman. Many of you know who Johnny Hartman is, I'm sure. Nightclub. You are so beautiful, and I am a fool to be in love with you is a theme that keeps coming up in songs and poems. There seems to be no room for variation. I have never heard anyone sing, I am so beautiful, and you are a fool to be in love with me, even though this notion has surely crossed the minds of women and men alike. You are so beautiful, too bad you're a fool is another one you don't hear. Or, you are a fool to consider me beautiful. That one you will never hear, guaranteed. For no particular reason this afternoon, I am listening to Johnny Hartman, whose dark voice can curl around the concepts of love, beauty, and foolishness like no one else's can. It feels like smoke curling up from a cigarette someone left burning on a baby grand piano around 3 o'clock in the morning, smoke that billows up into the bright lights, while out there in the darkness, some of the beautiful fools have gathered around little tables to listen, some with their eyes closed, others leaning forward into the music as if it were holding them up, or twirling the loose ice in a glass, slipping by degrees into a rhythmic dream. Yes, there is all this foolish beauty born beyond midnight that has no desire to go home, especially now when everyone in the room is watching the large man with the tenor sax that hangs from his neck like a golden fish. He moves forward to the edge of the stage and hands the instrument down to me and nods that I should play. So I put the mouthpiece to my lips and blow into it with all my living breath. We are all so foolish, my long bebop solo begins by saying, so damn foolish, we have become beautiful without even knowing it. Thank you.